His is the story of rock and roll. Flamboyant as they come, Andrew Loog Oldham was the first manager of the Rolling Stones. He created their bad boy image, produced some of their first big hits, and started Britain's first independent record label. Then he flamed out on drugs. Now Oldham has emerged a world away in South America, where he's found a new life managing rock and rollers in Espanol.
The ratones paranoicos, the paranoid mice, may be from Argentina, but their sound is all bluesy rock. Like the song No Llores, or Don't Cry, which is hard-driving and classic, a song produced and written in part by the legendary Andrew Loog Oldham. Today, he still looks the part of a rock impresario. Oldham's thin and gangly with a bit of the kink in his long hair. And at 66, he says that working with the Ratones Paranoicos has not only brought back the memories, but energized him in this latest stage in life.
Because basically, they're like the Rolling Stones. All I had to do was upgrade technically, and I fell in love with them immediately. They took great care of me.
His latest project has been with a young Colombian singer, Juan Galeano, who just put out Peregrino, or Pilgrim. La vida que llevo no me da
para poder compartir tu realidad. He writes, he reads, he plays every instrument on it except the drums, and he plays some of the bass on it. So he's doing all the vocal parts, he wrote the string parts, he wrote the horn parts, and the songs are just great.
But Oldham is never far from his past, as fans of satellite radio in the U.S. know. That's where he's heard daily, hosting Underground Garage from his home here in the Colombian capital.
Anyway, Andrew Loog Oldham here. More than happy to be apart from the general malaise by being here with you once again on Mr. Stephen Van Zandt's Underground Garage.
Holding forth on rock history, some of which he helped shape.
And take something that was both a single for the Rolling Stones and I, and on their sixth album, Aftermath, Paint It Black. Here it is.
My mother, if she was alive, would be very pleased because it's the first time in my whole life I've had a regular job. She really would be thrilled. I mean, this is the woman who, in 1965, when I had a Rolls Royce and five other cars, and I took her for a ride in the Rolls Royce, still turned around to me and said, "Yes, Andy, but when are you going to get a regular job?"
The job that made him famous began at age 19. That was in 1963 when Oldham first heard the Stones in a London club. Oldham done some publicity for the Beatles. Now, with the Stones, the new manager opted for an entirely different look, entirely different behavior. It was Oldham who fed reporters the now famous line, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" The Stones courted controversy with everything they did, from their gyrating performances to their bad manners in elegant restaurants. Under Oldham, Mick Jagger would become a sexually supercharged performer, and the lyrics Oldham produced, like those to Satisfaction, would push the envelope in a way that had never been seen in rock music. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards would be no lovable mop tops, and they wouldn't sing about wanting to hold your hand. Mark Kemp is an American rock journalist, and he couldn't stress enough Oldham's importance to the group's success.
The Rolling Stones had a dirtier sound than the Beatles, and they were kind of provided that alternative for kids who wanted that kind of bad boy image and that bad boy sound.
Oldham also lived the part. He now says he almost died from drug use three times. He broke with the Stones in 1967, and he went on to manage other bands, though, as Oldham puts it, he was out to lunch until the 90s, hooked on drugs. Redemption came in Colombia, where he'd moved following his wife, Esther Farfán, a Colombian actress and model.
And not only fell in love with her, but I fell in love with the country. I couldn't stand the idea of staying in England and becoming a relic.
Colombia is a country with a rich musical tradition. Oldham, in his characteristic straightforward way, says most of it bores him. But there are rockers here and in Argentina, like the Ratones Paranoicos.
I got the sand, pidió monedas y se fue.
At a rock concert in Buenos Aires, you can feel the energy, even the similarity to the Stones. Not just their frenetic frontman, Juanse, but the style of music, perhaps not surprising for a group that worshipped the Stones and studied the American blues that inspired Jagger and Richards. Pablo Meni is the bassist, and backstage after the concert, he says Los Ratones and Oldham speak the same language, rock and roll. Since 1989, says Meni, the collaboration has churned out 5 albums.
He's working with a legend. We knew all his works before with the Rolling Stones. We knew a lot about him. We never imagined working with Andrew before.
Oldham's got other projects, trying to publish his 3rd book on life as a rock impresario. And then there's the HBO series he's developing with Lou Adler, himself a famous rock producer. The pilot they're working on is a fictionalized series on the Stones and Oldham. But mainly, as it's always been, it's still about the music. Like Cara Verde, Green Face, in which Juanse sings about the Antichrist here, the Antichrist there, and what the Ratones call the boring sameness of life. For Oldham, it's anything but.
You could say that it's the wrong time to be investing in making records. But then again, I couldn't resist the songs. You know, it's as simple as that.
Juan Ferrero, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you're used to customer service and tech support from the other side of the world, you may be surprised the next time you place one of those calls. The person who answers might be in the United States. The recession has shifted the scales. Companies are hiring people to answer calls here at home. As a matter of fact, they're hiring those people in their homes, as NPR's Carolyn Buehler reports.
Maureen Quigley Hogan is the next generation of call center workers.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Maureen. May I have your name, please?
Quigley Hogan is at the makeshift desk in her home office in Virginia. She's wearing pink slippers, and she's taking a call from a woman in New Jersey who has a question about her credit card bill.
For verification purposes, may I have the last 4 digits of your Social Security number, please?
Quigley Hogan was unemployed for 10 years because she says she couldn't hold down a traditional job. She has rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia, a disease that causes severe fatigue.
It was hard to get to a job. The idea of going through a regular schedule of getting up and getting ready for work, I would be exhausted.
She'd worked in customer service for more than 20 years, so 2 years ago, she was thrilled to land this job, where she can work from home. And increasingly, companies that want to outsource their customer service jobs are happy with the arrangement, too. 10 years ago, it made a lot of sense to outsource these jobs to the Philippines or India. But that's changing. High inflation and double-digit annual raises in some sectors are pushing up the cost of labor in India. At the same time, wages in the United States are falling, and companies are rethinking the trade-offs associated with outsourcing. Richard Crespin is the director of the Human Resources Outsourcing Association.
When a company is deciding where to put something, they have to weigh in the cost of doing that, as well as the inconvenience of having something distant from you and not close to you in proximity, what I would call like the pain in the neck factor. So when wages drop in your home economy, you're less likely to move something over as the balance between pain in the neck and labor arbitrage comes more into alignment.
Experts say outsourcing is still accelerating for jobs in IT services and manufacturing. But even before the recession started, companies were starting to realize that offshoring wasn't the best option for other services, like handling calls about credit card balances or broken cell phones. That's according to Phil Furst, an outsourcing analyst.
People have found that losing the customer service capability for having local staff who can understand products and services well and can deal in context-based situations, it hasn't fared that well in offshore locations like India.
Today, Furst says in some cases, workers in India are making only about 15% less than workers in, say, Nebraska. He says that's about the point where companies start thinking it's worth it to hire an American worker instead of a foreign one. And one of the cheapest models and biggest trends right now, home workers, like Maureen Quigley Hogan. There are an estimated 60,000 people like her doing call center work from home.
It provides a lower cost point than other traditional means of onshore customer service.
That's Chris Carrington. He runs Alpine Access, the Denver-based company that Quigley Hogan works for. He says the low overhead of having home-based workers allows him to charge 20% less for the same services that brick-and-mortar call centers in the U.S. provide.
We don't have big buildings and we don't have all of that infrastructure cost, and so we're able to pay our people more as well as lower the price for our customers that we serve.
Even with these cost-cutting measures, American workers are still the more expensive option. But industry watchers say so-called home sourcing will continue to grow as companies look for quality that used to be harder to afford. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
We're joined now by Tina Brown of The Daily Beast. She brings us reading recommendations for our regular feature, Word of Mouth. Today, stories of managing in tough times, in business, in life, and after a war. Good morning, Tina.
Good morning, Renee. Good to talk to you.
Let's start with a piece in Harvard Business Review. It's an interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And people might remember he stepped down in 2000 when Starbucks was at the height of success, didn't expect to return, only he did 2 years ago to rebuild the company. What's interesting about this particular article is its title, We Have to Own the Mistakes. What does he mean by that?
Well, he talks about how you really have to own up to the mistakes that you in your company have made yourself, face them, share them with your staff in order to move on. And he says it's like when you have a secret and get it out, the burden is off your shoulders.
One thing, though, he says is he, by coming back, could do things another CEO, an outside CEO, could never have done. And among them was, I mean, he could truly embrace what he called, it's a cliche in a way, but the culture, the core values of the company.
What he really saw was that the culture had gone off whack, that it had just, two things had happened. First of all, there had been a volcanic climate, suddenly a huge recession where customers' entire patterns had changed, and also a sense that the company had lost touch with its customer core value thrust, because this company had very, very defined corporate culture, which was really about serving the customer, about being a decent human citizen, about giving people pleasure, but also giving people service in a way that he felt had kind of gone off track.
There are people who see Starbucks in a very different way, kind of, oh no, another Starbucks.
That's what he wanted to get away from, and he really set about remarketing the company and reinventing it. And he also said, you know, how everybody would, of course, want him to cut costs aggressively at a time of restructuring, which is what most people would, of course, mandate. And he did cut costs. But he also did something very, very inspiring, in my view. Just at a point when everybody was saying you must cut costs, you've got to refocus, you've got to do all this, he actually took 4,500 members of his company to New Orleans to spend a week doing community service, working there, and then having a conference about their core values. And it was a very sort of enlightened, visionary, but also rebranding exercise where he says, this is a company that cares about people. What's the biggest statement we can make that says that? And he did this. And it was a terrific success and really did help an enormous amount in reminding people that Starbucks actually was a company that cared about people and customers.
Another example of a kind of growth is last Sunday's New York Times Magazine piece on 20-somethings. And Tina, here actually it's an article that many might set aside initially thinking, I think I've read this before, 20-somethings living at home. But in fact, this article gives a whole other underpinning to what's going on with 20-somethings who are, in a way, not quite growing up the way they used to.
Well, this writer, Robin Marantz-Hennig, is talking about something that sociologists and psychiatrists are sort of beginning to think of as emerging adulthood. You know, she says, we now know, for instance, that the brains of young people are still developing at the age of 25. And the author says, maybe it's only now when people are allowed to forestall adult obligations without fear of public censure that the rate of social maturation can finally fall into better sync with the maturation of the brain. You know, in other words, actually, the brain isn't really mature until 25. But in the past, economic, social circumstances have forced kids out really before they're truly mature, and that now that there are these new economic and social circumstances, that they are actually taking longer to mature. And of course, we also have, to accelerate this issue, a terrible job market where kids are finding a tough time anyway getting a job. But it is an interesting question. I mean, I have to say that I tend to feel, having read it, that this is really much more an index of privilege than not. I mean, you have to ask yourself how fast kids returning who go to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq have to mature, like it or not, whether or not they are matured mentally, putting themselves in great stress and danger or something is going to really change their maturity. There's no question about it. But it is an interesting thing because it is very much a modern phenomenon of kids continually going back home to live, sort of looking to their parents all the time still for not just financial help, but also sort of emotional help.
You finally take us back in history, and you're suggesting a book by Juliet Nicholson called The Great Silence, written from the shadow of the First World War to the dawn of the Jazz Age, to a time I think very few Americans even think about, this moment after young people in Britain were forced through a really terrible time of change and death for many of them.
Yes, I think one of the reasons I felt a little impatient with the findings of emerging adulthood was I was simultaneously reading Juliet Nicholson's wonderful book, The Great Silence, which does talk about the moment when Britain lost literally the flower of its youth in that terrible, terrible war to end all wars, as it was called. And she describes brilliantly in a series of social anecdotes and snapshots of real people, 35 characters going about their daily life, below stairs people as well as royalty, as well as famous writers and artists, where she dips into their diaries, into their letters, and creates a portrait of these 2 years, which she calls the Great Silence because of the famous 2 minutes of silence where everything in England stopped at one moment and the war dead were remembered. What we don't think about is the devastating trauma of what it was like when 1 in 7 young men in England had died. And she talks about how the everyday scenes of such loss and grief that no one could really enjoy or rejoice or feel there was a peace because there'd been too much loss and pain in the country. I mean, she describes scenes like, for instance, riding the bus and suddenly some woman would just break into wild tears as something had reminded her of her son or her brother or somebody in her family. Or she would talk about men walking the streets of London wearing these strange, eerie tin masks because their faces had been shot away, which became a regular sight in the UK at that time. And she also describes a terrifically interesting chapter actually on a surgeon called Howard Gillis, who was so affected by the tin masks that he saw that he developed a revolutionary plastic surgery technique that actually reconstructed faces and, of course, became a lasting legacy to the medical world. So it's really, I found, an absolutely gripping piece.
For you, do these tales of survival, do they add up to any one thing?
Well, to me, it's really about character in the face of stress and how, in the case of Howard Schultz, he showed enormous character and audacity and vision. In the case of these kids, it seems that they haven't really faced up to the stresses of people like Schultz are writing about yet. They are unwilling to face them, if you like. They haven't yet had their test that could perhaps be their defining character moment. And, of course, the people in the Great War, they were given the ultimate test, and they had to meet it in the most terrifying way, and did meet it, actually, and did so with enormous courage, with a very tragic outcome. But you do have to admire these people who returned under such terrifying circumstances and simply had to pick up and carry on.
That's word of mouth from the Daily Beast's Tina Brown. Tina, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Rennie.
You can find links to Tina's reading recommendations at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. is facing a potentially catastrophic shortage of primary care doctors and other health professionals. Now, the nation is about to expand health care coverage to tens of millions more Americans, so many more people are going to be seeking medical care, a situation that threatens to stress the system even further. Today, and for the rest of this week, we're going to explore a primary care system overwhelmed. To see how the shortage is playing out and some of the solutions being proposed, we sent NPR's Julie Rovner to Maine. It's one of the states that's leading the effort to solve this problem, and she's with us in the studio. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robert.
From the economics textbooks, we know that shortages are caused either by too little supply or too much demand. Which is it with primary care?
Well, unfortunately, it's a bit of both. Let's start with the demand side. That would be the patients. First, we have an aging baby boom population. By the year 2030, we'll have more than 70 million seniors. One of every five Americans will be over the age of 65, and as anyone who's ever been in a doctor's waiting room knows a little too well, older people use more medical care, they have more medical problems. Then we have the good news, bad news of the new health care law, which will give an estimated 32 million more people insurance who didn't have it before, and a lot of them will be looking for primary care doctors, so it's kind of a double whammy.
That's the demand side. On the supply side, the question is, where are the doctors?
Well, doctors who are in training are going into every field except primary care. According to a report earlier this month in the New England Journal of Medicine, less than a fifth of all the students graduating from medical school this year are likely to end up practicing primary care. They're all becoming specialists.
For the money?
Well, it's partly the money. Primary care doctors, which include family practitioners, internists, and pediatricians, earned a median salary of about $191,000 last year, according to one major survey. That's about half of what a dermatologist earned and barely over 40% of what a cardiologist made. Now, if you graduate from medical school with student loans in the neighborhood of $200,000 or so, you can see why more and more of those students are opting to become specialists. But it's also a lifestyle choice. Primary care doctors work long hours, including nights and weekends, and it's much more emotionally demanding work than something like radiology, where you're basically looking at pictures all the time.
So what's the solution? How are we going to get enough primary caregivers for everyone who needs them?
Well, it's definitely not going to be easy, and like everything else in healthcare, there's no single answer. But there do seem to be some ideas out there, both to help people who are practicing now become more efficient and get better paid, and to help train more people.
Okay, let's then hear Julie Rovner, part one of your series. It's a profile of a member of a vanishing breed, a doctor in solo practice.
Dr. Crute in Kathy Clement's office, can you hold for a moment?
Kathy Crute wants to get one thing straight from the get-go. She is not a dinosaur.
No. I mean, I think patients love a small practice. My receptionist can recognize a lot of patients' voices over the phone. They know who they're talking to every time. They don't have to go through a whole chain of command.
And the patients in the waiting room at her Portland office second that notion. Lori Warhol has been seeing Crute for nearly a decade.
I just think it's better service to come to the same person all the time and have one person looking overlooking you.
And it's not just Crute herself, says patient Mike Greenleaf. It's the entire atmosphere.
The staff's great, and they know you on an individual basis. It just makes you feel that much better.
Crute actually came to her solo practice late in her career. She was one of the first doctors to become a certified family practitioner. She worked in a small group for 10 years, and later a larger one.
And realized very quickly that that was not where I wanted to be.
The emphasis was on moving patients in and out as fast as possible, and she didn't feel like she had enough control. Crute said she had some friends who were solo practitioners.
I was like, well, yeah, I guess I can do it too.
That was 10 years ago. Since then, she's built a tight, efficient little team around her. So efficient, in fact, that Crute only works 3.5 days a week. She gets in at 8:15 and says she rarely leaves the office after 5:30.
David, we do have samples if you want to stop by and pick up some. You'll just have to do 2 of the 10 milligrams because we only have 5s and 10s in samples.
It's easy for the staff to know the patient, says office manager Amy Asali. Most of them have been with the practice for years. She literally inherited her job.
My mother actually was her office manager when she was in the group practice. She retired, so I hopped into the position.
Crute credits Asali with keeping the practice financially viable. Crute says Asali's always on the lookout for various hospital or state or insurance incentives to boost cash flow. But Asali, who's also answering the phones on this, the receptionist's day off, concedes her job is a challenge. Keeping a small practice afloat takes some doing these days.
Definitely a juggling act. Without having the overhead of you know, a larger practice helping us. You know, it's a game week to week, making sure we've got enough patients on the schedule.
But Kroot says as long as the bills get paid, she's okay. She says she's definitely not in this for the money.
You're not driving the latest BMW.
No. No, I'm driving a 10-year-old car.
Although she wishes she and her staff could spend less time on insurance company bureaucracy.
We have a part-time person just doing referrals, and that's a huge piece. And we also spend a tremendous amount of time on the phone with prior authorizations for medications.
That's medical speak for getting permission to prescribe a specific drug. But what really keeps Kroot up at night is what will happen to her practice and her patients when she retires. She's 63.
Planning working probably another 3 years.
So she's spending some of her time trying to recruit her replacement. Among her targets, the family practice residents currently in training at the nearby Maine Medical Center. She's got all their photos hanging on the bulletin board in her office, but she knows that finding one to take on a solo practice won't be easy.
It's probably going to have to be someone that doesn't have a huge debt.
Which doesn't leave a very large pool of young doctors finishing their medical training. And she's competing for those residents with local hospitals and huge doctor groups like Martin's Point, located across town. Some on her staff derisively call it Walmart. But Walmart or not, those groups can offer something she can't, some certainty that they can begin to pay back their medical school loans.
That's probably the biggest roadblock to having a small practice, because I can't guarantee somebody a salary coming out of residency.
So, for her patients and for Kathy Kroot, the clock is ticking.
And Julie Rovner is here in the studio with us today. And Julie, you went to Maine because that state is leading efforts to solve this problem of the primary care shortage. What are they doing?
Well, one of the things they're doing is pioneering something called the medical home. And it's a way to bring together health professionals as a team, doctors, nurses, other types of health professionals, to really take some of these big groups. In fact, Martin's Point, one of the groups we heard about in that piece, that's right, is one of the places that's doing this. And it's really an effort to make some of these big groups act more like the very small groups that we just heard about, make it really seem more like a place where everybody knows all the patients. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to see by going to Maine.
Hence the homey name.
Indeed.
And this is what you'll be reporting on tomorrow?
Yes, I will.
Okay. And it also was summertime when you went to Maine. That was another reason for choosing it, perhaps?
It didn't hurt.
Okay. NPR's Julie Rovner. Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is a dreadful disease. If you get it, your lungs stop working and you die. It's rare, but not that rare. By some estimates, around 100,000 people in this country have the disease. NPR's Joe Palka has this story about a man with pulmonary fibrosis and some research that may point the way to a treatment.
It bothers Robert O'Rourke that so few people have heard of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. He wants to change that, so he's telling his story.
I got diagnosed in the fall of 2006.
At the time, Bob was in charge of public relations for Caltech, one of the top research institutions in the country. His symptoms were shortness of breath and a dry cough. Not very specific. His pulmonologist wanted more details.
Did a lot of breathing tests at the local hospital. And then the clincher was the CT scan. And that's very evident that there's a lot of scarring going on.
Bob's lung is full of scar tissue. That's what happens with this disease. And scar tissue can't take oxygen from the air and get it into the blood like normal lung tissue can. I first met Bob a year ago when I was in California on a fellowship. I had no idea he was sick. When I saw him last month, things had changed.
April of this year, things went south rapidly. And since then, I've been on oxygen 24/7. And that's the way this disease is. You can ride along very nicely, but then it takes a dip.
Bob still looks like Bob, sounds like Bob, jokes like Bob. The difference is he's got a long plastic tube running from his nose to an oxygen tank. He says idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis isn't a painful disease, at least not in the usual sense.
But it does have pain because of the breathing. That you're always working at getting your breath.
Since his diagnosis, he's met other people with the disease. He says newly diagnosed patients don't always know what they're up against.
This is a very serious disease that there is no cure. And I don't know whether the docs don't like telling you that news or I don't know, but it's something that the reality of it all, you've got to learn how to How are you going to live with this? How's your spouse going to live with it? How about your kids, your grandkids? It is a death sentence. There's no other way to put it.
And right now, the only way to delay that death sentence is a lung transplant. Bob's doctors put that option on the table back in April.
They said, we want to start looking at you as a potential transplant candidate. So my pulmonologist said, now you have got to put on your PR face of all the times you've been doing this. Because when they come around, there'll be a whole team come through to interview you. If you look like a dumpy old 71-year-old man, you're not going to get a transplant. So the first guy that came to see me, the first one that came to see me was a psychiatrist. She looked like she was 12. Then came the head of surgery for transplant. All kinds of doctors coming through at UCLA to check me out. And they had to each write a report about this Irish kid in bed 12.
I guess Bob convinced them he was worth keeping around. He's on the list. Now he has to wait for the call. The word idiopathic and idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis means no one knows what causes the disease. That's one reason why it's been hard to find a treatment. But Mary Armanios has some ideas. She's a clinician and researcher at Johns Hopkins Medical School. She thinks the scarring may be a natural process of aging. It just hit Bob early.
If you look at folks who live over 100 years of age, invariably they have a very, very early stage of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So that's why we've kind of started to think about this as aging in the lung, and in some people it happens more quickly or more prematurely than in other folks.
Armanios thinks this aging process is related to an enzyme called telomerase. Telomerase is in every cell of the body and is critical for preventing premature aging. So she looked at this enzyme in people with pulmonary fibrosis.
At least 10% of them have defects in telomerase.
Armanios has been working with Carol Greider, who won the Nobel Prize last year for discovering telomerase. They're beginning to think that the defects in telomerase may be the cause of a whole host of diseases, not just lung disease.
Without having a clue about cause, we don't have a shot. But now with genetics, we can really begin to move forward.
Move forward and find treatments for pulmonary fibrosis and other diseases. I'm guessing nothing would please Bob O'Rourke more. Joe Palca, NPR News.
More All Things Considered in a moment.
Out in the Gulf, there are some encouraging signs. New research shows that bacteria are consuming the underwater oil plume. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, that's a surprise. Last week, another group of scientists said they had not found evidence of oil-eating bacteria near the spill.
Last week, oceanographer Christopher Reddy from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution said his team had found a big underwater oil plume in May and June. But curiously, the waterborne bacteria that like to eat oil apparently had not found it. Reddy said microbes are about as predictable as teenagers.
Microbes are pretty selective in how they eat oil. Sometimes they kick in, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they do the easiest work, they don't do the hard work.
The hard work is what scientists had been hoping to see. Bacteria consuming the more toxic chemicals in the oil plume and rendering them harmless. Reddy said sooner or later, the bugs should show up. Apparently, they have.
There's this unique cold-loving bacteria.
That's microbiologist Terry Hazen with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California.
They actually grow better at 5 degrees than they grow at room temperature.
Hazen and a large team of scientists found these new cold water bacteria in the oil plume 3,000 feet deep. There are several kinds of microbes, in fact, and they're eating the oil.
Oil is the only carbon source down there deep, so they immediately take advantage of that. And of course, they have undoubtedly been adapted to that over millions of years.
That's because oil has been in the water for millions of years, bubbling up from the seabed.
The Gulf has natural seeps that have been putting the equivalent of an Exxon Valdez spill into the Gulf every year.
So why hadn't other scientists seen the bacteria? One possibility is that they were looking for low oxygen levels in the water and didn't find them. Low oxygen is the principal sign that lots of bacteria are eating oil. But Hazen says in this case, ocean currents and the use of dispersants has spread the oil out into a thin veil of tiny droplets. So the bacteria are spread out too. The reason Hazen's team found the bacteria is that they looked for bacterial DNA and enzymes that their microbes express when they eat oil. That makes sense to microbiologist Benjamin Van Mooy.
The thing I'm learning from this project is there is no shortage of surprises from the microbial point of view.
Van Mooy was on the team from Woods Hole that did not find the oil-eating bacteria.
Every oil spill is unique because the oil has a unique composition, and it's also being released into an environment with its own unique chemical and physical factors at play. And then there's also the microbial community.
Scientists working on the Gulf spill say that's why it's hard to predict how the remaining oil in the Gulf will behave. Conditions in the Gulf are different from, say, Alaska, where the Exxon Valdez went aground. The BP oil was released at the sea floor under great pressure. Dispersants spread it out into cold water, but as it rose, it reached much warmer water. Hazen says it appears that the combination of bacteria and ocean currents can degrade and disperse the remaining oil in a matter of weeks.
It does fit with what we've seen. So in the last 3 weeks, the plume at depth is completely undetectable.
You're saying the plume is gone?
Yeah.
But gone doesn't necessarily mean the Gulf is free of BP's pollution. Van Mooy points out that oil has scores of chemical constituents. Bacteria consume the low-hanging fruit first. The harder stuff takes longer to digest. And scientists who track oil say the plume may thin out in one place and then pop up in another. They're continuing to look for signs of that all over the Gulf. The research, published in the journal Science, was funded by the Federal Energy Department, along with support from BP through a university consortium. Scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say they're following the fate of the microbes and the plume. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.